Okay, so today we continue our examination of the quantumizing model. With Hamiltonian. This one. And again, this sum is to be intended over all the edges of the lattice. So we saw that for g much larger than j, the ground state is unique and is the tensor product of the state plus on every site, where again, plus is just 0 plus 1. Okay, it's the eigenvector of sigma x with plus one eigenvalue. And we saw that we can characterize this ground, this phase by looking at correlation functions, in particular the two-point correlation function Cij that I will define in this way. So you can easily see that this object is zero exactly in this state. But in the whole phase, because there is a gap, so the gap plus the unicity of the ground state, implied through the Lib-Schutz-Matisse theorem, that the correlation functions decay exponentially over some characteristic correlation length psi. Sometimes people, when they talk, so this is a very important fact that you will, it also has a counterpart in high energy. So you know that if there is a finite, if there is a gap, so you remember that we have a relationship between the gap and the correlation length. So if there is a gap, then the propagator is also decaying in this way. So people sometimes do not mention the unicity of the ground state. They just say, oh, if there is a gap, correlation functions decay exponentially. In some sense, this is because if you have a degenerate ground state, so you might say that there is no gap between these two states. So somehow when people say, oh, there is a gap, they are already excluding the possibility of degeneracy. But just to make sure, you need a unique ground state and a gap to have this theorem. In fact, let's see what happens in the other limit. So in the limit g going to 0. OK. So now the Hamiltonian is just this term, the Ising term. So we see that we have exactly for g equals 0, two states that are both ground states with the same energy. and they are psi 0 1 being all spins up, or yesterday I called it 0 0 0, and psi 0 2 all spins down, or 1 1 1. So you see that these states, every time I compute the energy of this state with this term, I get a plus one, right? Because here I get a plus one, but here I get minus one times minus one. So every time I compute one of these terms is plus one. They all commute, so the total energy, the sum of all the single terms. So plus one times minus j is minus j. So the total ground state energy in this state is equal minus the number of edges times j. Okay. It's the minimum energy. So we see that the ground state is not unique. So this has profound consequences. So first of all, notice that the Hamiltonian has a symmetry that is called the Z2 symmetry. So the Z2 symmetry is generated by this operator. T, that is the global spin flip, meaning I operate with sigma x on all the spins of my lattice. Okay? So this is a non-local operator, but we don't care. It's not a term of the Hamiltonian. It's just some operator. And this operator defines a group with two elements that is just the operator itself and the identity. And this is because T times itself, T square, is the identity, as you can easily check. Okay. And you should notice that this is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian, meaning the Hamiltonian commutes with it. So this means that if we are in some state, psi, which has some expectation value of the energy E, and then we go to T psi, they will have the same energy. So notice by passing that this T is non-trivial. What I mean is that psi and T psi are different. Okay? So this is what you need. This is the definition of a symmetry. So you must have some non-trivial operator on the Hilbert space, because it could happen that there is some space, some subspace, or even the whole Hilbert space, T also does nothing on 2 psi, right? Just transforms psi in itself. So it's not really a transformation on our Hilbert space. That is a do nothing. But if it is non-trivial and it commutes with the Hamiltonian, then we call it a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. It means just that there are different states that have the same value for the energy in this case. Okay. So can you see why T commutes with the Hamiltonian? So T contains sigma x's. So it trivially commutes with all these terms because sigma x and sigma x commute. Now sigma x and sigma z do not commute. But, so just for sake of simplicity, let's look at the chain. So we have terms of this type that contain sigma z, and our transformation is x everywhere. So this part commutes to this part because here it's like we have the identity. You remember when we have a local term, this part commutes to this part. And xx and the zz, so they anti-commute twice. So you can just work out easily the algebra and see that they commute again. So they commute. It's a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So notice, by the way, that the psi zero in this regime has the same symmetry of the Hamiltonian. This means I can write it in two ways. Either that T and the density matrix associated to psi zero commute, or that T psi zero is again psi zero. So psi zero is conserved. So the state and the Hamiltonian have the same symmetry in this regime. And in this regime, also correlation functions decay exponentially. But what here? If I apply T psi zero, sorry, T on psi zero one, I get X at psi zero two. And they are not only different, they are even orthogonal. So T is the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, but it is also the generator of the algebra that is non-trivial in this subspace. Yep.
I was thinking in the case of the classical lighting model, where the set of symmetry is seen in terms of the magnetization, right? One phase is zero, the other phase is not zero.
Yep.
So in this case, something happens, something similar happens with the wave function.
Yep.
Of the ground state. So in this case, one can consider the order parameter to be the wave function?
No. So we do the same thing. So this is a very good point. So not only these correlation functions are zero, but if we compute the magnetization M, that is 1 over N, the sum over all the spins of sigma z, so it's just the straightforward quantum version of the magnetization in the classical case. This is also zero. And now something will be different here. We will have a non-zero magnetization, as we will see just in a second. So psi 01 and psi 02 are not conserved through the symmetry. In fact, the symmetry is exactly the operator that brings you from one to the other. And this situation is called symmetry breaking. Namely, the fact that the ground state does not have the same symmetry of the Hamiltonian. What are the consequences? Okay, so let's look at the magnetization, which is defined exactly like that. And you see that this is either plus 1 or minus 1, depending if you are here or here. Okay? So even if this is written in this quantum formalism, in each of these two limits, the system is classical, right? You just have to compute expectation values in an eigenstate. So it's just a classical system. Moreover, if I take the limit for I minus j going to infinity of Cij, in either of these two states, we find M squared. So not only they do not decay exponentially, but actually they have a finite value at long distance, and this is called long range order. So this is a very typical situation. Symmetry breaking implies the existence of one observable that distinguishes from the two states, which is the order parameter, local order parameter. So this symmetry breaking, it is also called spontaneous. And the reason is very similar to why it's called spontaneous in the classical case. But now we have plus something interesting that is quantum that usually it is a bit overlooked. So do you remember why the symmetry breaking is spontaneous? Yeah. So this means that we always find ourselves in one of these two, and not in any possible superposition of them. Because a superposition of them is still a ground state. Okay? So in particular, the symmetric combination is a ground state. And the symmetric combination of these two states, so the symmetric state psi sim is 1 over square root of 2 of psi 0, 1 plus psi 0, 2. So this is also a ground state. And in this state, there is no symmetry breaking. So psi sim commutes with t. Now, by this, I mean the density matrix associated to this state. Right? So in this state, you will have, again, the same situation. You will have that there is no long range order, and the magnetization is zero. But this state does not come in play. Spontaneously, you will find you yourself in one of these two states. Incidentally, see that this state is also like a Schrödinger cat. It all spins up plus all spins down. So it's like saying, oh, alive plus dead. Well, now you can tell me, well, every superposition, even just up plus down, is alive plus dead. But when you are concerned with just one body or few bodies, this is not really the Schrödinger cat. There is no apparent paradox. The point here is that this is a many-body superposition, a macroscopic superposition. So it's really like a cat. Really like a cat. And so you see that one of the reasons, in which we can say that Schrödinger's, you know, macroscopic superpositions are not seen in nature is because of spontaneous symmetry breaking.
say that these are the two ground states, either everyone up or everyone down, because that's the easiest one to see from the Hamiltonian, but I could find by diagonalization any two other linear independent states. So when you say that we have spontaneous symmetry breaking, that only makes sense if I make a perturbation of the Hamiltonian, right? And see if that perturbation is small, where does the system tend to be, right?
Yeah.
So in this case, you're claiming that these are the only two states that the system can choose for any yeah. given perturbation?
Yes. So your colleague is saying, look, I could look at the psi-symmetric and psi-antisymmetric. They're also a pair of orthogonal states. But the system doesn't choose between one of those two. The system chooses between one of these two. So somehow, the perturbations select a basis. Okay. So this is material for thought. Why the perturbations select this basis? So I cheated when I say every possible perturbation. So every possible perturbation in the Hilbert space cannot be, right? Because there is nothing special from the mathematical point of view in that basis. So the only special thing is that our Hilbert space is written like this. So let me. So we are saying our degrees of freedom are these spins, C2, 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 and not some other, I could make a huge basis transformation in the Hilbert space and define a new set of spins, or even not define as a new set of spins, but just have one big Hilbert space that is 2 to the n dimensional. But let me fix the tensor product structure that is saying these are the spins that I can access. And by I, it means everyone, also the environment. So if the perturbation is local, in this tensor product structure, now you know what it means local, then that basis is selected. So it's selected the basis that is a product in this tensor product structure. And the way it happens is, as your colleague was suggesting, with the so-called method of sources. So we put a little perturbation to the system. Okay? We compute the ground state. So this perturbation, what we'll do, we'll lift this degeneracy. Okay? Then we compute a new ground state, and we are in one of the two sectors with the magnetization that is positive or negative. Although, because of the perturbation, now it will be 1 plus epsilon or minus 1 plus epsilon. And then we send epsilon to 0. So I have to say that, yeah, so this way of seeing how symmetry breaking happens, I never found it very convincing. So what does it mean that we first perturb, then we send the external field to 0? Somehow it should remind us that the ground state is very sensitive to the initial conditions. A better way of seeing this is to see it in a dynamical way. Imagine that we prepare our system in a state such that the magnetization is positive. Okay? And then we evolve it in time. What is the tunneling time to the sector where the magnetization is negative? If the tunneling time is finite, then at equilibrium, you will have mixed all sectors. And when you take the averages, you have to take the averages over all the possible states. And this is what happens, for instance, in the classical Ising model in 1D for every finite temperature. So only at zero temperature the two sectors split. Otherwise, they mix. And you have zero total magnetization. You don't have this sensitivity. But in 2D, for instance, the tunneling time is exponentially large in the sides of the system. Have you seen this argument? Have you ever seen this argument? Okay, so very quickly, because this is just the classical thing, but imagine that we are in some state. Whose mean magnetization is positive because there is a prevalence of zeros. And we want to go to the other side, right? So we ideally we want to have all ones. So I will start to have to add ones, right? So let me see. I am adding ones. So how much energy am I paying? Well, you see that I pay energy. Let me put zeros here for the sake of simplicity. Every time, because my energy is sigma z, I pay energy every time two sigma z that are nearby have a different sign. So I pay energy here, 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 here. So you see that the energy scales with the sides of the boundary of my bubble. So delta E scales like the sides of the boundary times some energy constant. So this is the number of spins on the boundary. And in the thermodynamics, so when I want to go over the other side, then I have to involve a number of spins that scales like the linear sides of the system. So if this is L times L, this should be L of the order of large L. So you say we pay an energy, so we don't like to do that. On the other hand, you have to see how the entropy changes, right? And the entropy scales like the log of the number of configurations. And the number of configurations on the boundary, so is something like, so you see that for every element of the boundary, I can change it in four ways. This is four because the coordination number of the lattice is four. On a generic lattice, it would be some number mu. So I can do it mu in mu ways times mu ways times mu ways, blah, blah, blah. So for every L, this scales like mu to the L. So this means that the entropy goes like something like this. So when I make a change in my configuration, because I want to try to go to the other side where there are more ones than zeros, my free energy changes in this way. So free energy is this, the change in the free energy. So it will be something like or so you see that the thermodynamic limit enhances this sign. So if this is positive, in the thermodynamic limit, this will be a very large positive quantity. Means that the free energy is increasing a lot. So we don't want to make that change. But when this is negative, the free energy is going down a lot. So we want to make the change. So you see, this depends on T. If T is smaller than J over mu, then we do not want to make that change. And I think I maybe there is a sign mistake. So when temperature is small, the energy wins. So we want not to increase our energy too much. When T is large enough, entropy wins. So even if we have temporarily to increase our energy, the amount of the increase of entropy makes up for it. So this is the generic mechanism by which you can get trapped in one of the two sectors. So this is a dynamical situation. It's called ergodicity breaking, means you cannot explore at the same time all the configurations equally. So something similar is happening here too, that can be summarized with the method of sources. Okay, let's see what happens if we perturb our system, we look at the new energy, and we see which state we selected. But in the quantum case, there is one specificity that is very important. So because in the classical case, once we start from one configuration, we stay in that configuration, basically forever, we can prepare a classical mixed state. So I call it rho. That is, I prepare P1 systems with the magnetization M plus, some positive magnetization. And P2 systems with magnetization M minus. Okay. I can write it in this way. So this is some configurations of states. The fact that I write it as cats, as brackets, does not mean that this is not a classical state. Right? This is just the projector onto one configuration that is a classical configuration. And this is not a coherent superposition. This is a classical probability distribution. I just have probability P1 of being here and probability P2 of being here. It's not a coherent superposition. And P1 times I will be stuck here. When I read, when I make a measurement, I will find plus. And P2 times I will be stuck here and I will find the minus. So you can see that I have encoded information. Right? This is a bit of information. A bit of information is a probability distribution over a coin. And this information is robust. It stays there forever because of ergodicity breaking, because of this, unless the temperature is too high. So this is the reason why a hard drive conserves information. They are built upon this principle. So unless you put your hard drive in an oven, it will conserve the information. If you put in the oven, then this term we flip this sign and you lose the information. And we see that there is a symmetry breaking also here, also in the quantum case. So let's see what is the quantum case situation. Imagine that now I prepare my state in a coherent way. So my psi zero will be psi 0 1, the one with plus magnetization, with an amplitude now, alpha. And psi 0 2 with an amplitude beta. And if I compute the density matrix of this, right? Whereas if I wrote this as a matrix, this would be just P1, P2, 0, 0, right? There are only the diagonal elements. I don't have M plus and minus. Okay. So these are the populations. So the probability of finding our state here and the probability of finding our state here. So alpha squared is like P1 and alpha and beta squared is like P2. But now we have more, right? We have quantum mechanics. We have the off diagonal elements. So because of symmetry breaking, are also these lasting forever, these coherences? No. And the reason is the following. So before I show the reason, the implication, if this were the case, then we not only would have classical information encoded forever, but also these phase relations encoded forever. And this is what is called the quantum bit. And this is also Schrödinger's cat, right? This is a macroscopic system. Can we have something macroscopic like this last forever with a generic coefficients? Let me show you why this doesn't happen. So the reason why these are robust is that in order to go from psi 0,1 to psi 0,2, I have to change all the zeros in all the ones. So there is a global operation. And this, because it is global, I can have an interplay between energy and entropy. In this case, it goes like the boundary. So that there can be a critical temperature because of this, because I have to do a global operation. But now look what happens if I have, for instance, this is just an example. I have this state. So it's the symmetric state. And I act on it with one operator on one side. So I just act with sigma z on one side. I'm not trying to flip all of them with the sigma x. Can you see that this becomes immediately the orthogonal state? So there is no way. So even if I pay an energy to do this process, this energy is finite. It doesn't scale with L. Whereas the entropy always scales with L. So these processes can always happen at every finite temperature. And they're very, very fast. So if I have processes that mix all the possible phases relations, in average, these phases relations in this basis, that is the local basis, give you zero. So these terms go to zero. It's called defacing. And it's part of the decoherence process. So in quantum mechanics, defacing is very fast. And basically tells you why we do not see quantum mechanics macroscopically, and because of the locality properties of our Hilbert space and of the operators that we, the lab, and the environment can use. So we have seen that symmetry breaking does not imply protection from defacing. But it does imply protection from tunneling between the two classical states. So this is protection from dissipation. So symmetry breaking is a phenomenon that is in essence classical, that it survives in quantum mechanics, insofar quantum mechanics also gives you classical predictions. So now a question should arise immediately. Is there a quantum version of symmetry breaking? A truly quantum version in the sense, so don't get me wrong, this symmetry breaking is quantum in the sense that I phrased it in terms of operators that commute over the Hamiltonian. But when I say a quantum version, I mean, is there a version of symmetry breaking that has as an effect protection from defacing? This is what I mean. And believe it or not, this is an open question in quantum mechanics. So, and there are different points of view. So Kitaev discovered that in four spatial dimensions, the answer is yes. There is protection from defacing. So now for people who do cond math, the spatial dimensions are three. And why? So why for us they are three and not 11 or 10? So you know that when you talk about 10, 11 dimensions, some of these dimensions are compactified. And in condensed matter, we don't care about compactified stuff. We only care about low energy, large scale. So we only care about the distances that one can measure macroscopically. And I find it really amazing that the low energy macroscopic physics still contains very important fundamental questions like this. Is it possible in quantum statistical mechanics to have quantum metastable states? So this is another way of phrasing it. This is a classical metastable state, but it's not a quantum metastable state. Are quantum metastable states possible at all in quantum statistical mechanics? So this is an open question. Okay. Now, I want to show you. So we start the transfer matrix method. That is essentially a classical method, but why I will do it is because thanks to this method, we will show several things. So first of all, we will find an easy way to compute correlation functions. Then we can talk about universality. And scaling limit the scaling limit is precisely what I just mentioned, the fact that the only important quantities are the quantities that are at long distance, not microscopically, that do not depend on the details of the Hamiltonian at the microscopic level. So somehow we should make a limit in which we only look at large distances, or which is the same, we send the lattice spacing to zero and we see what survives. So we throw away all the corrections due to the lattice spacing, and this we call it the scaling limit. And if condensed matter has to work, this has to be universal. So why it's really important for condensed matter? Because in nature, materials come in different samples that they are not pure. They're not described by one Hamiltonian. They have a lot of disorder. They have a lot. And every sample is different. So when we say, oh, this is iron and this is iron, you know, the microscopic theory is quite different. But in the scaling limit, it's just one universal thing that we call iron. Okay, so in order to understand universality, we do need to do the transfer matrix method. And the third thing that we will do through this is the quantum classical mapping. It's a very important topic. And it says that the statistical mechanics of a d-dimensional system, a classical d-dimensional system, is the same that the imaginary time evolution of a d minus one quantum system. These mappings are very useful because sometimes you know stuff in one of the two settings, and then you can translate it in the other one. One very important example of this quantum classical mapping is path integrals. In some sense, path integrals is a way to go from a purely quantum mechanical description to a description that is like statistical mechanics. Okay, so first things first, let's see the transfer matrix method. So we start with our Hamiltonian that is up there. And we want to compute the partition function. Okay? So our goal is to compute the partition function z. That is e to the minus beta h, the trace of this. And we want to, actually what we want to do is to start with the 1D classicalizing model. That I will define in this way. So let me remember what symbol I used. H, J. Okay, so these are Ising variables. These are just numbers that can be plus or minus one. Okay? And we are on a chain. I could have written the same thing with the sigma z. It would still be the same thing, right? Because sigma z also, in a classical configuration, is just a number that has two values, plus one or minus one. Okay, now let me define, we keep it here because we will use it all the time. K as beta j, and the lambda as beta h. Okay? And we want to compute the partition function for this Hamiltonian. So z is, so do you know what trace means in this case? So trace means just the sum over all the possible configurations of these numbers. Okay? And then we have exp of lambda plus kappa si si plus one. Okay? This is what we want. Okay, so let me expand this sum. Right? So this is a sum in an exponential. These are just numbers. So I can expand it. I can write, okay, I have this outer sum, then right now we don't care. And we can write it as e to the lambda s1 plus k s1 s2 times e to the lambda s2 plus k s2 s3, and so on and so forth. And in order to make things work, I can put periodic boundary conditions on my system. Periodic boundary conditions. Because in the end, I don't care. If the chain is very large, I don't care whether it's closed or open. But this helps me mathematically. So the last term is e to the l sn plus kappa s n s1, and that's it. So I write it like this. So you see I have a product of terms of this type. And the value of this object depends on the value of psi and psi plus 1. So I can call it. So it's a function of psi and psi plus 1, right? So I can decide that these are the matrix elements of some matrix. So let's write it as a matrix then. So we are in the basis spanned by psi and psi plus 1. So when they are both, and they can have values minus 1 and plus 1. So the so we have the 1 element, the minus 1 element, the 1 minus 1 element, the minus 1 minus 1. Okay? So the 1 element is lambda plus k. The minus one, so sorry, I have made a mistake. Here I have to put, because I want this to depend on the two spins as one, as I can write it like this. So sorry about this. So this is correct. I break this product in terms with one I and I plus one. Okay, so the minus one element, you see this is zero. Here we just have k. And here we also have k. Yeah, yeah. So we see in the end that this is, so Z is the sum over all the possible configurations of this matrix n times. So it's this matrix, it's n times. Or in other words, trace T to the n. Sorry? Yes, there is a minus here. Right. Thanks.
One
Let me see. You're saying I'm counting too many times. So maybe there is a half. There is a half. Okay. Let me just put the two there. Thanks. Okay. So let me put this. So this object is the transfer matrix. Now I can diagonalize it. And the eigenvalues are, let me call them lambda 1, lambda 2, and they are so these are the two eigenvalues. So now that we know the eigenvalues, computing this object is easy because the trace does not depend on the basis. So this is just lambda 1 n plus. The trace is the sum of the eigenvalues. Lambda to n. And I can write this thing as of course. So you see that let's put ourselves in the case in which lambda 1 is greater than lambda 2. Then in the thermodynamic limit, that is n going to infinity, this term, yeah. Then this term goes to 0. And we have that z is just lambda 1 to the n. So the free energy density, OK, so the free energy is minus kT log z, which is just minus kT n log lambda 1. And the free energy density, which is just the limit of this when n is infinite, OK, so we have this. And notice that this object, so you can do your substitution and remember that kappa and lambda are beta j and beta h. So this object for beta finite is analytic. Which is another way of saying that there are no phase transitions in the 1D Ising model for finite temperature. So you only have the possibility of a non-analyticity when B goes to infinity, which is zero temperature. And then, yes, you have a phase transition. OK. So how much? Yeah. Okay. So tomorrow we will compute the correlation functions, do the scaling limit, and see the quantum classical mapping, and finish this one topic. Questions?
state, which was against classical state, and then you gave the example of the superposition of quantum. But in terms of measurement, you can't really distinguish one from the other.
Yes, you can. So this is the essence. If we couldn't, then there will be no quantum mechanics. But we can measure in different bases. So if you think of the Stern-Gerlach experiment, we can measure in the x direction and in the z direction, which, I mean, even classically, we can measure in two different directions in space. But in this case, x and z direction means that we can measure observables that do not commute. Okay. And their expectation value does depend on the phase relations. So maybe what you want to say is that if our wave function is the wave function of a very large Hilbert space, to reconstruct the whole wave function, the whole density matrix, requires an exponential number of measurements. So in practice, you cannot reconstruct the whole wave function. But definitely, you can distinguish between, for instance, the symmetric state. So psi sim and psi anti sim can be distinguished by measuring some local operator. So in particular, in this case, is sigma x. So sigma z does not distinguish them, but sigma x, yes.